Time to take a look at climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and Professor John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW as well. And they come by the last Monday of every month to talk weather and climate with you. And if you have a question for them, this would be a good time to join in. Here's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And don't forget, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Steve, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
It's great to be back in this cold, windy environment.
John. Hi, good.
Hi,
nice
Larry.
Nice to see you guys. And I have here in front of me the Wisconsin Week news article.
Oh, right.
Phone has been ringing off the hook.
People saying, I didn't know you looked like that. That's not what I imagined.
Did you see the Red Sox insignia there on my shirt, Larry? Yeah, that was the day after the World Series was over.
I remember that well. So it was a nice article.
Yeah, it was.
And Wisconsin Week, I don't know how people... Well, I bet you if people go online, that'd be the way to do it. Go online to www.news.wisc.edu/WisWeek, WISWEEK, or just do it. I bet you if you Googled or put a Wisconsin Week magazine.
Yeah, probably turn up, yeah. And I sent it to my mom that way.
Is that how you said it?
That's how I said it.
It's on the website. So right. All right. Well, listen, I'll tell you what. Jim in St. Croix Falls has a question for you, so let's go to Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm going to Colorado skiing in a week. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if there's any storms coming in.
Mm. You know, I took a quick look at the 1 week outlook. Not that I really believe it, but just to get a sense of it. And they were calling for increased precipitation, and I think it was in the northern part of Colorado area.
And it's going to stay cold in the western two thirds of the United States. So. Even if they can't get real snow. Do they make it in Colorado, too?
Oh, yeah.
They must. So I think there'll be ample opportunity to snow, but it might not be in a lot of real snow.
Okay,
depends on
thanks.
Where you go.
Yeah.
Which one are you going to?
Winter Park.
Oh, that's a
taking
nice one.
Taking the train out there.
Oh, that's great idea.
Cool. Yeah.
How long does that take?
Well, I'm going to drive to Omaha, and then it's just overnight, basically.
Gotcha.
Oh, awesome. Oh, that's nice.
Oh, that's
cool.
That's
a really good idea.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, speaking of snow, reminds me of the snowiest town in Wisconsin. Mm. You know which one it is?
I'm going to guess Hayward.
Oh, I would have guessed Hurley.
Hurley is correct.
Yeah,
with an H.
Right.
Well, it has the record for the greatest seasonal snowfall, monthly snowfall, and depth of snow on the ground.
Oh, okay.
On January 30th, 1997, snow was piled up to 60 inches on the ground. The monthly record was 103 inches in January of 97.
Wow.
And the greatest seasonal snowfall was that same season, when 301 inches of snow fell on Hurley.
I would have won that one. I knew it was about 300.
300 inches of snow. Jeez.
Oh, my goodness. Somebody else wanted to know, where's the best weather in a southern state? Is that for right now, I wonder?
Yeah, I don't know what that means. Best weather in a southern state.
Maybe overall.
Overall.
Jim Packard says it's overall. What's the best weather?
I'm trying to think of one that's not humid.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll tell you.
I got mine.
All right. What's yours?
I would go with something around Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was going to say Jacksonville, Florida, because they're far enough north that tropical storms almost never are an issue, and they're ventilated by the Atlantic Ocean, and it's beautiful down there.
And they have a professional football team.
That's true.
You can't beat that. Okay, so
I would go with Jacksonville.
Right. Well, I'd want to get into the mountains in order to get the humidity out, personally.
Yeah. And go to the islands off the coast of Jacksonville.
Oh, there we go. Key West. There's another good place to live.
Another good spot. Well, let's see. I have a friend who lives, this really isn't south. This is San Diego, California.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that would, yeah.
That's a nice place.
That's a nice area. That's actually kind of dull, though, weather-wise.
Yeah, it never rains in Southern California.
Right. Like the old song says. Yes.
Right. It hardly ever does.
And when it does, it's really not very good.
Right.
Although they've had a lot of fire.
Fires, right, yeah.
They got the risk again, actually, right now.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah.
The risk went up again.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let's see. What's the, do you know the state record for coldest temperature?
Yes.
You do?
No.
John?
I'm going to say it's minus 45.
Minus 54.
Well, it's minus 55.
Minus 55.
Okay. That's
cold.
Couderay in Sawyer County reached 55 below twice in February of 1996.
Yeah, that's right. And embarrassed Minnesota had minus 60 during that stretch.
Yeah, wow. And Milwaukee at that same time had 26 below zero during that same stretch, 1996.
Yeah, we had 100 straight hours with a temperature below zero in February 1996 here in Madison. 100 straight hours.
When were we that cold again, or even close?
For that long, it has only been the one time since I've
been. Both that and the snowfalls. I mean, those were all, 96, 97? So it was after that?
Well, this was the year before the heavy snow in January 97. But that 96 was incredible. January 96, we had a lot of snow here in Madison, and it was falling.
You know, it's amazing.
I don't
even remember that, and I was here the whole winter, and I don't remember it being that cold. Well?
Yeah, no.
I wait all year for that, so I always remember.
Karen in Portage, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Good morning.
Morning.
I am getting extremely annoyed at listening on radio and TV, and they're throwing La Nina, El Nino. One's forming, one didn't. One is, one won't. It's going, it's changing. So which is actually going to be active this winter? And as a farmer, the weather forecast for basically snow and extreme cold to see whether I go into full hibernation or if I can stick my nose out all winter, and I'll hang up and take the answer off the air.
All right.
Yeah, this year we're going into a La Nina episode, and actually it's strengthening. And what that is it's a warming in the tropical Pacific, or cooling in the tropical Pacific Ocean areas. And then that influences weather up here in the continental U.S. But its influence up here in Wisconsin is weak enough that it's hard to discern. I mean, really what it does is that usually leads to a lot of precipitation in the northwest and drying in the southeast.
Yeah, and the signal here for La Nina is not very easy to discern. It's a lot easier when it's an El Nino. We get a pretty strong signal here, but not for La Nina. But I can tell you, though, for the next 10 days or so, it looks like the threat of us staying below normal in terms of temperatures is going to persist through those 10 days. So I don't know what the seasonal forecast is, but it strikes me that if you get snow up in western Canada at high latitude and you have a strong jet across the Pacific Ocean, which we have right now, which will be unaffected by the La Nina, that tends to reinforce that. That can lead to a little bit colder than normal if the table is set correctly in November. And it looks like it's beginning to get set the right way. That's my prediction.
Now, does La Nina doesn't affect us then as much as an El Nino?
Right.
Not as coherently anyway, yeah.
Yeah. The El Nino signal is really big for us, and usually it's really bad, I think, for the farmers because it's generally warmer
and wetter, right?
And enough. We don't get enough snowfall.
Oh, drier.
Snowfall.
I'm sorry,
drier.
That's right. It's less snow. Yeah.
And so what is an El Nino for, because
Right. So the El Nino is a warming of tropical waters off of Peru.
Okay.
And it's kind of interesting because this is where the atmosphere and the ocean interact together, and it's kind of hard to imagine that something that's occurring so far away actually impacts our weather. I like to sometimes think of it as, in terms of an analogy or a simple model, is if you look at a stream, and the stream's flowing and it's flowing pretty strong and you got a big rock there. Well, if you pick that rock up and you move it someplace and you drop it, then that actually impacts things downwind. That's kind of what an analogy for what the El Nino's doing. It's changing something really big in the tropics that's influencing patterns, flow patterns around the globe.
Okay, gotcha. And, John, you were saying the next 10 days are going to be cold. Now, you guys usually don't like to go out too far with your – why are you so pretty sure about 10 days out?
Well, in this particular instance, the setup is of a very large scale. It's a large-scale atmospheric setup over the entire continent of North America. Not likely to be easily perturbed by a weak little storm that might come along and disrupt that large-scale setting. And that setting is keeping very, very cold air in central and northern Canada, poised just to our north. So it's going to be really cold in places like Winnipeg and southern Ontario. And it's going to get awfully close here. So we're going to be under the gun for really cold air for the next few days.
Now, what are Winnipeg, what would you predict for them? Really cold, what do you mean by really cold?
Oh, I'd say probably high temperatures in the teens, maybe single digits, maybe a couple of days coming up. And that's unusual for this time of year. Yeah. And they'll get like that routinely in January, but not in late November.
Yeah. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our guests as we talk climate and weather with them. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. What is the state's record for greatest 24-hour snowfall in Wisconsin?
John, you're the snow guy.
Yeah, but it all happens up near the lake, so I mean it counts.
Well, this one did not happen.
Okay, it's Milwaukee, 24 or 25 inches in.
No, I think it's more. Well, the 24 or 25 inches is pretty close.
Okay,
it's Neillsville.
Where's that?
Clark County. So Neillsville in Clark County is recorded 26 inches on December 27th. 1904.
Wow.
Pretty
awesome.
And they didn't have electrical snowblowers, I bet.
Yeah, right.
They probably had tractors, though.
Well, they just brought out rollers in Boston. They brought out rollers and just pounded the snow down, turned it into pavement.
If there had been any. Is that what they did?
Yeah, before the turn of the century, maybe even into the early part of the 20th century. Didn't try and shovel it away. You just crush it.
Oh, that's not a bad idea.
And then
idea.
You just, you know, move
pretty
on
soon
top
your
of
road
that.
Is.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
If you have 301 inches.
Yeah, the road gets kind of high. Right. Exactly right.
Oh, boy. We'll be back with Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They'll be with us right up till 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking climate and weather now with our weather guys, Professor Steve Ackerman and Professor John Martin from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Really happy to have them along. Larry Mueller here. You can join in if you have a question or comment. The number, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Jane in Wausau is up next. So let's go to Jane. Hi, Jane. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Hi, gentlemen.
Hello. Hi, Jane.
I have a childhood memory that I think might have evolved into just a story, and I'd like to find out. About 35 years ago, I was in grade school, and my memory is there was a rule that if it was 50 below zero, school was called off. I lived in Solon Springs, which is about 30 miles south of Superior. Mm.
I know Solon Springs.
Okay. We had no school for 10 days in a row.
Wow.
And I think it was because it was below 50 below. Yeah. Is that possible?
Yeah, January 1977, am I right?
Well, yeah, that could have been it.
That was one of the coldest stretches that the northern Great Lakes states has ever seen. And it was a combination of wind and low temperatures. It was really, really strong wind chills. Where I grew up in Massachusetts, I think we had a similar rule. It might have been a little bit more lenient. You know, we're a little bit less sturdy than people out in Solon
Springs. -40.
Yeah. I think it was minus 40, but if the wind chill or the temperature was at minus 40, we didn't have school. We had 2 days off in a row in January of 76, but I remember that I was very envious of people who lived out here in January of 1977 because we were hearing stories about that, if you were attuned to it like I was, all the way out in New England. So I can believe it's true.
Huh.
Yeah, I remember that. I was living in Colorado at the time. I just moved to Colorado, and I remember seeing the Midwest was just freezing because Colorado was warm as could be because there was a big high over ridge over there.
Yep.
And so I was like at 1 o'clock in the morning, I was biking up to work and, you know, without a heavy jacket or anything, not even a hat or gloves.
Amazing.
I mean, it was that warm.
Just amazing.
You wouldn't have been doing that here.
I would not. I thought of that. I looked at that. I said, wow, who would want to live in Wisconsin?
Yeah. Was there snow involved in that too, Jane? I bet there was, right? There was some snow.
Yeah, I recall. I think that the snowplow had snow like 4 or 5 feet high on the road.
Yeah, I bet it's a big lake effect event as well, on top of it being freezing cold. What an amazing time. Yeah, I bet it's right.
Does this mean that our parents walking uphill both ways to school is actually true?
I'm not prepared. I can neither confirm nor deny the truth of that.
But I'm certain you can exaggerate this minus 50.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for calling. Paul in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Paul. Paul, are you there? Oh, wait a second. Let me turn the volume up. Here, Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for calling.
I remember from when I was a child, back in the 50s and early 60s, my father was a meteorologist with the U.S. Weather Bureau here in Milwaukee.
Hmm.
And I remember during snowstorms when it was particularly windy, if when he came home from work, he would go out in the backyard and pick what he, I suppose, thought was a representative area and make a snow measurement. And we lived about a mile and three quarters from the airport office where he worked. And he would then, he would stick his hand down in the snow, look at it, and say, oh, about 6.5 inches of snow. And then he'd call in the to the office and say, oh, we've had 6.5 inches of snow.
Yeah.
And I asked him about that, and he says, yeah, that'll go in the record. I was wondering if snow measurement during windy snowstorms had gotten any more sophisticated than it was, say, 50 years ago.
No.
It's still a very active research question, and it's got climatic implications. Of course, you want to have a nice, accurate record of snowfall amounts and accumulation. It's not an easy problem. I think I've heard a number of different ways that it's done. Sometimes people will use a snowboard that they try to put out of the wind and brush it off and measure it fairly frequently, sometimes every hour or every 3 hours. And then another way that is sometimes used is you take a whole sample of measurements in a given area, maybe a backyard of some place or something, and then you take the average of them on under windy conditions, and you usually have some reasonable confidence that you're getting a decent measurement. But it's not an easy problem.
Yeah, I think we've advanced to using rulers.
Yeah,
yeah. And you know,
you got a calibrated hand.
Right. And the snow itself, doesn't that, I think we've talked about this in the past on the show too, if it's a kind of a wet snow versus a light snow, that has quite a difference, doesn't it?
It does, and also the wind speed, which packs the snow down. So the frequency of measurement, or interval of measurement matters with wind speed. If you wait too long, you got a really packed snowfall, whereas if it's a windless night, the same amount of snow might look a lot deeper because it's not being packed down by the wind. So there's all kinds of variables that go into that. The official measurement that tells you something about the storm, though, is the liquid equivalent measurement. So you know how much liquid equivalent fell out of the sky that day, and that measurement's pretty robust, but it does not translate to a robust measurement of the snow.
Wouldn't that, though, require that you also take the sample that you got from a representative area, because of snow blowing over areas leaves, you know, some areas with nothing on it and others with drifts 8 feet tall.
Yeah, I suppose there's probably room for error there too as well, but I think rain gauges, especially heated ones that'll melt frozen precipitation, are considerably more sophisticated than some of the other methods we're describing for measuring accumulating snow. So you end up taking at least some of the error out of the problem that way.
Yeah, you try and capture it while it's still falling as opposed to getting to the ground. And,
exactly.
And they have that similar problem with rain, measuring rainfall as well on a windy day, you know, that the rain's blowing to the side. So how do you capture that? And so a lot of the instruments, even though they look simple, they're actually sophisticated in cutting down the turbulence so they actually do fall in and not blow by.
Interesting. Thanks, Paul.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Brian in Milwaukee, you're next. Hi, Brian.
Hello. It's my understanding that it takes the Earth 23 hours and 56 minutes to rotate on its axis. Now, I'm wondering, at least in the tropics, why the sun doesn't rise 4 minutes earlier every day. So at the end of the year, it would be rising about 20 hours earlier. I've never been able to figure that out.
That's a great question. And the answer is that as we're spinning on our axis 23 hours and 56 minutes, we're also orbiting the sun. And it takes us in one day, you know, if you just think of the Earth as being fixed, in one day as it goes around the orbit of the sun, which takes a year, in one day we'll rotate
1/365th or something.
Right, yeah. We make up for those extra 4 seconds.
Yeah.
So those 4 seconds are made up by the orbit of the Earth around the sun.
Is there a book or someplace I could read a more complex explanation on that? Because I still don't understand it, really.
Well, there probably is, and I'm going to sound biased, but I just published a textbook on dynamic meteorology, and we investigate this thing called the Coriolis parameter, how the rotation rate of the Earth influences the deflection of winds. And the Coriolis parameter is supposed to be 1 over twice the rotation rate of the Earth. But it's not quite exactly what you'd think it would be, because there's 2 different days involved, and Steve's talking about them. One is the solar day, which is 24 hours long. That's the time in between sunrise at the equator on, you know, March 21st and sunrise on the equator the next day. And the other is the sidereal day, how many times mm-hmm. the Earth, how long it takes the Earth to rotate once on its axis. They're not the same, and as a consequence, you have this weird period of time. So that book has something about it, but it's not the best place to go. Probably a physics book, though, has one, physics textbook.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really good to see diagrams of how that works.
Yeah, because
I'm moving my hand around here, as if you could see. But
it's working. I can see what you mean.
Thanks, Brad. Gary in Brookfield, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, thank you for taking my call there. And the only thing I got a question about is how much does the solar flares of the sun affect the weather?
You know, there's some work looking at that in terms of solar flares. There's a 22-year cycle. And if you look at various patterns on the Earth, there's also tends to be a 22-year old cycle. So those cycles match up. But just because there's a cycle doesn't mean that there's a causation. One causes the other. And so every now and then there are theories that pop up that look at and say, well, this is how the solar flares affect weather. And when I say weather, I mean where we live. Solar flares are, you know, high-energy particles that interact with the upper atmosphere and affect the electrical properties of the and magnetic properties of the upper atmosphere and change that for sure and affect communications. But there's been no real convincing, I'll say, long-term explanation of a causation between solar flares and weather.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, I just took notice that, according to the Discovery Channel, that the other the Arctic caps of the other planets are starting to melt, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's probably, on the other planets.
Yes, in our solar system.
Oh, I think the only other one with one is Mars, I think. And that has a cycle.
Yeah, you have to dig out that show and take a look at it. I think the thing is that it's true that when you... solar flares are active, there's more energy that's coming out from the sun. But a lot of that energy is at higher energy, so, you know, higher energy than ultraviolet. And so for Earth, we have this nice atmosphere that screens that stuff out. But perhaps on these other planets like Mars, where the atmosphere is a lot thinner, maybe you don't screen them out as much, and so maybe it has a bigger impact.
Yeah.
Interesting. I just thought maybe it'd be causing the global warming, too. Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I think John in Pecatonica, Illinois, has something related to global warming, too. John, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I do have a related question. You know, we were told that global warming is man-made, mostly, and I just have to take issue with that because it seems like the sun at this point is warming up itself, and that could be the major cause. And I'm wondering what your guests have to say about, you know, is it carbon dioxide that we are creating that's causing global warming, or is it the sun heating up?
Mm-hmm. Isn't there a measurement instrument that was out in the early 1980s, the Irby satellite,
right,
that actually did an Earth radiation budget?
Right, and that's still looking at it.
So now it's 15 years in or more than that, 20 years in. What's that said about the sun's output?
Well, it's cycles. So now, you know, the cycle is that the output is going up very much, but... if you look at the correlations again in the past, the correlations are not there where you would expect it to go up and getting really strong global warming, particularly in the last 10, 20 years, as we've seen in the warming, and how that does seem correlated with greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane.
And so it strikes me that, you know, the availability of that measurement allows a person who might be skeptical or looking for alternative explanations, which scientists are doing too, of course, looking for alternative explanations. It does allow you to maybe think, oh, scratch your head and say, maybe there is something there. But then it doesn't stand in the face of the huge amount of evidence that points toward carbon dioxide. And not only carbon dioxide, but the fraction of oxygen in the atmosphere has gone down at precisely the right amount to match burning of fossil fuels as the source for the increased CO2. So it's a perfect match.
I just
read that recently, and so that makes it even a more compelling story that it really is a human industry induced change in our atmospheric composition that drives this warming. It doesn't explain every aspect of it. Almost surely that's true, but it certainly drives the bus.
Okay. Thanks, John. Dean in Johnson Creek, your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I was just curious. I've noticed that when we have predicted snowfall, a lot of times we'll see a prediction of an amount, but we don't see that with rain. I was curious if you knew why that is practice?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I think that it is because the snow makes such a more obvious impact to people's lives that knowing the amount of it somehow tells you a little bit more about the impact you're likely to get. But you're exactly right. And I remember thinking that as a young boy, thinking, boy, it's easier to make a forecast in the summertime because nobody cares how much rain you're going to get. You can just use an adjective. But you can't do that in the wintertime. You can't just say heavy snow. People want to say, well, what do you mean by heavy?
Right.
You
know?
And I think it's because of the impact that it makes.
Yeah, although I seem to remember going back to August, our local weather forecasters were saying, expect very heavy, up to 10 inches of rain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I was thinking of that too, particularly this past August where we had a lot of that rain during that time period that I guess wrecked the grapes and caused some local flooding. And yeah, they were trying to predict as much as an inch or as much as a quarter of an inch. I don't think they tried to get too specific.
Right. And again, it comes down to impacts because usually that's followed with small streams and rivers may overflow their banks. Yeah. If it's not going to be that much, they won't even come close to saying how much rain usually.
Yeah.
Although it does start to creep in. I will agree that even on cases with light rain, you sometimes or a moderate rain, you hear a little bit of a creep in terms of, quarter of an inch of rain or something.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Dean. Amy in West Bend. Hi to you.
Hello. I was just wondering if you can tell us what the outlook is for a white Christmas in the state of Wisconsin this year.
The state? That's easy.
Good up north. Not so good to design.
100% in Bayfield.
Someplace.
It's about, 60% of the time in Madison? So that's kind of representative of the southern part of the state, and about 100% of the time up in Bayfield or Hurley.
I figured the northern part was pretty much a given, but the southern part is.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I'd guess that it's climatologically 60%, and I just got a feeling we're going to have a colder than normal December. I'm going to say 75%.
All right.
75%. You heard it from John.
Let's write that down.
Yeah. Write that down. We'll peruse that.
Come December.
I'm waiting for it. I'm waiting for the reviews.
John in Gurnee, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hello. Great program.
Thanks.
When I was growing up in Florida in the 50s, every afternoon during the summer, it rained.
Hmm.
Now, I've been living in Florida for the last 12 or 15 years, and there's been no rain at all on the West Coast, Sarasota, Tampa, St. Pete, that area.
Okay.
Any idea what's going on there?
And that's where you used to live too, John?
Yes.
Okay, same area. That's really interesting.
Boy, yeah, no, I haven't. I was going to ask that same question.
Yeah.
What side of, if you switch the coast? But boy, how close were you to the coastline?
Well, Sarasota's right on the Gulf of Mexico, and it's the same up and down the West Coast. St. Pete, Tampa. Well, St. Pete's on the Gulf, of course. Tampa's on Tampa Bay, which is 8 or 10 miles actually inland from the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole area used to get just lots and lots. We had, I can remember one time when I was very young, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old, we got 7 inches of rain in 2 hours.
Yeah, no. You get those really tremendous gully wash of thunderstorms.
Yes, you literally couldn't see the buildings across the street.
Yeah.
But now, for the last, I don't know, 10 or 12 years at least, where we have a house in just east of Tampa, which is not really that far away, we haven't had 5 days of rain all summer, every summer.
Yeah. Now, east of Tampa is interesting. The further inland you go, I think, the more likely you ought to be away from the sea breeze front, which probably kicks up a lot of those thunderstorms. So a mile or two or five can make some difference. Another thing that comes to mind is, I bet you the area is a lot more developed now than it was 50 years ago.
Oh, heavily.
Yeah, and that could rob some of the atmosphere of moisture and some other ingredients that might make some of those thunderstorms a little bit more memorable. But I'd probably guess, if I had to, that the biggest consideration is exactly how close you are to the coast.
Yeah,
and
wow.
5 miles can make a difference.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Thanks for calling, John. Appreciate it. And Mike and Amory has a question for us. Mike, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
Sometimes during the winter, I hear people make the comment, it's too cold to snow. Why would it be too cold to snow, and what temperature would that be?
It is never too cold to snow.
Yeah, that's what I like to hear.
Because, I mean, it snows in Antarctica, and you can't get much colder than that. Yeah, I mean, generally what happens is, and I think this is where that phrase tends to come from, is that, you know, when the water, I mean, when the atmosphere gets colder in general, there's less water molecules in the atmosphere. But the water molecules are always there, which means you just need to find a way to get them to stick together and get big enough to fall out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, and it also, that's a very good point. And the other point is, in a given location, like, say, Madison, when the temperature gets down to about minus 10, the number of days in history on which it has actually snowed when the temperature is minus 10 is vanishingly small, because the conditions of very, very cold air and ample moisture to get snow out of it at our latitude is very, very rare. So I think people have a sliding scale. If it gets really cold here, they probably say, well, it's never snowed here at minus 20. But and they lead to that conclusion.
So we should just come up with a new saying that deals with probabilities.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's about 95% likely it won't snow if it's this cold.
Okay, it's too snow yeah, to likely. It's too cold to likely snow.
Yeah. And nobody wants to talk to you.
Right. Well, let's find out what Gene and Ashlyn has to say. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I've been listening to all this complaint about human beings causing a change in the weather, exacerbating the natural plan. Anyway, as just one example, Greenland is called green because it used to be green long before human beings were numerous enough to cause any problems. What's the story about Greenland?
Well, there's a little history on that one. I think it was named because right at the coast, when the first explorers got there, right at the coast, it was green.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And it was very lush right around sort of the edges of the country. Is that right?
Yeah, and it was that was a medieval warm, the so-called medieval warm period. Yeah. From
so
about
climate change did influence that.
Yeah, 1,000 to 1,300 or something.
Well, yeah, that's
something
right.
in that range. Yeah. And, yeah, so that's a natural variability in the climate system, and there's plenty of natural variability in the climate system. The thing to be careful of is to cherry pick, is to say, well, since there's some variability already there, that means anything that we see in our own lifetime or in two lifetimes is part of that variability and not want to investigate it further. And it turns out that this the variability we've seen in the last 50 to 100 years far exceeds any variability that we can trace through observations, remote and paleo observations, that's occurred in the past 600,000 years, I think they now say.
Right, yeah.
So it's the rate at which this change is occurring and also some of the circumstances that are coincident with that change that really point towards a human impact.
Yeah. I was listening to a program and somebody, you know, this was sort of being argued and somebody said, well, back in the 50s, there was all this talk about global warming. And then that changed. And I don't remember what the conditions were like in the early 50s, but...
Yeah, there were some cold winters, I think, here in the central part of the country. But I think I remember hearing about the ice age coming in the 1970s because of a couple of cold winters.
Right,
one of them
yeah,
Jane
I
referred
see.
To, yeah. the winter of 77. Yeah. But it wasn't a well-developed branch of our science at that time.
Yeah, because as you're pointing out, you need a bunch of evidences to come together.
Yeah,
and
you need a bunch of people thinking about all those different aspects of it, and that wasn't happening until quite recently, mid-1980s. Yeah.
And Jim Packard was reminding me or telling me, and maybe he got it from somebody else, that the naming of Greenland was done to induce people to come to settle there.
Yeah, it's a great marketing ploy.
Right, yeah.
You bet.
And Iceland was named to inhibit the settling of the country. which sure makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, Ted in Greenland, Green Bay, have you got a question, a quick one?
Yes, thanks, guys. Just wanted to ask about the snow belt. I've got a place up north of Eagle River on the state line up there, and they keep saying, well, you're on the edge of the snow belt up there, and what exactly is a snow belt? How far south does it go? Does it fluctuate its borders?
Yeah, okay. Well, we got about 20 seconds to answer that.
Offhand, I'm not going to be able to answer just how far south it goes.
Either.
It does
depends.
Fluctuate from year to year, and the way I think you would draw it is look at snowfall, and actually if you search on a map or on the web, you'd find it. And just look at the average snowfall over a 30-year period, and you'll see that around the Great Lakes, downwind of the Great Lakes, you get these big, large amounts of snowfall, and at some point it rapidly drops off.
Yeah, the colder it is, the more snow you get in Eagle River. That's probably a safe bet.
Thank you very much for calling. And guys, thank you.
Thank you,
Larry.
We'll see if John's prediction is right come the last Monday of December.
Right.
Thanks,
Christmas
guys.
Will already have happened.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. Stay with us. Lots in store.